whenever I talk about this to nursing home staff or hospice staff, almost everybody has a story of something like that, where somebody either awakes out of a coma or someone has severe dementia, and then somehow right before death, they become conscious and coherent.
My guest is Dr. Ken Doka, Senior Vice President for the Hospice Foundation of America. His specialty is grieving, death and dying, 35 books. The most recent, When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End, runs a gamut from the mundane to the paranormal, all about dying, and some of the unusual experiences associated with that. And I've had more than a few. It can change your perspective on living. Thank you for being willing to put up with me and answer questions and talk about your book. I appreciate it.
I'm delighted and I'm honored to be on your program.
And the cool thing about this is the entire gamut. Synchronicity, coincidences, it's everything. Could you give us a background on what you wanted to put across with your information?
Sure. You know, I think like many people who've been in the field, and I've been in the field now for 50 years, you come across all kinds of unusual stories. And as people tell you about their experiences, or you witness experiences that people have and family have in the last moments of life. And I began to become interested in that. And what I wanted to do is I looked at the material. I found basically two types of books, or actually, you might say two issues. One issue was, which is, as you said earlier, most of the books carried just one topic. They spoke about extraordinary experiences after bereavement, or they spoke about near-death experiences or nearing-death awareness. But that's all they emphasized. That's all they spoke about. And I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to do a book that really talked about all of these topics and introduced people to all of these topics. And second of all, 90% of the books, maybe even more, were what I called either in one or two categories, true believers who really said, you know, this happens and this is what it means and this is what it tells us. Or debunkers who would say this is just a lot of malarkey. And I wanted to write a book that I thought would be fair, a book that would say, here's the evidence. Here's what people have experienced. Here are some of the things we know about this. Here's what the research says. Here are some of the explanations that are given for it. And, you know, and let the reader make his own choice as to how much credibility they give to these experiences. But I thought it was important to do both of those things. And I like to think that the book does that.
I agree. Let's dive into terminal lucidity, because that's one that people are sometimes shocked at when that happens at the end of life. Can you give us an example?
The example I use in the book, and really the first research that was done on that was really in the 1880s. And it was a woman, Katrina, who grew up, who was totally nonverbal and had what we now call severe intellectual disabilities, what in those days, what when I was growing up would have been called severe retardation. And she never spoke, and she was in this institution. And then the day of her death, all of a sudden, and she was comatose at this point in time and totally uncommunicative, she sat up and she sang, she was in Germany, so she sang a Lutheran hymn about her, about dying, essentially, and about, you know, the expectation of salvation after she died. And it so shocked the chaplain and the director that much, that many years later in the 1930s, when the Hitler regime was trying to kill people like her, euthanize people like her as beings not worthy of life, or something like that was the term they used, living unworthy of life. They actually strongly opposed it, much, you know, putting themselves and maybe their institution in danger at the time. So, you know, so it really had an impact on people. And lots of times, whenever I talk about this to nursing home staff or hospice staff, almost everybody has a story of something like that, where somebody either awakes out of a coma or someone has severe dementia. And then somehow right before death, they become conscious and coherent, mm-hmm. and give messages. Remarkable experience that actually I didn't know about until I began to do the research on this book.
Well, and there's another one in there that I also like, a woman who occasionally she would say something, usually it was a swear word, and she would also spit on your shoes. And then she snapped out of that for a few moments to apologize to her caregivers and said she had to act that way and she wanted to be forgiven. And I thought, wow, you know, just that knowing of this is what I have been doing. I can't not do it, and forgive me. And then she checked out.
Yeah. I remember that story as well.
Well, there are some other stories in here at the end of life when people start noticing that the person who is close to death starts having visions or conversations with people who are not in the room. And it may be just, you know, little bitty snippets. And sometimes it's long drawn out for a period of weeks. Can you address that?
Yeah, we call that, and actually that was originally research done by Callanan and Kelly, two nurse researchers, and it's called nearing death awareness. And what it really means is that sometimes as people are approaching death, they have a couple of unusual kinds of experiences that they report. So it may be that your mother is dying and she's saying, last night I spoke with grandma, and you're thinking, Mom, grandma's been dead 35 years, you know, we've got to go light on the pain medication or something. Or another one where somebody's quite ill and they're almost immobile and they start talking about traveling. I'm going to catch a plane, I'm going to catch a train. Or the one that has most meaning to me, simply because my father experienced that, was kind of the sharpened awareness of death. And in my dad's case, he was dying. He knew he had cancer. He knew he was close to death. He was in hospice care, and he knew what that meant. And one day he woke up, and my mother called me up. All the three kids were taking turns watching him, you know, being with my mother and helping take care of him. We all had our days of the week to do that. And she said, I think you better go come down here. Something's going on with Dad. And I said, well, what's going on with Dad? And she said, well, he keeps asking, am I going to die? Am I dying? Am I dying? Now, he wasn't asking the question, do I have a terminal disease that's one day going to kill me? He knew that, but it seemed to be much more imminent in his mind. And so, you know, I got my father on the phone and I said, what's going on, Dad? And he said, am I dying? And he meant actively dying. And I said, well, you know, are you feeling anything different? Are you in pain? You know? And he said, no, he says, I just have this feeling. And so, you know, my brother was taking care of him that day with his wife, and my sister and her husband came back from Pennsylvania, and I came down from Poughkeepsie to New York City, and we stayed with him that whole day. And we were, you know, just around him and just talking, and he was going in and out of sleep. And finally, about 8 o'clock that night, he said, I'm feeling better now, and I think you should all go to your old rooms, you know, go to sleep. And we stayed a little bit more with him, and then we ultimately did that. And then he died that night. And my sister always felt bad that, you know, that we didn't stay with him, you know, until the moment of death. But I think he needed us there, but I think he couldn't pass until we were not in the immediate presence. Right. I think he needed to be alone for that. And, you know, and it's important that people understand this one, I think, because very often, sometimes people get false hope. He's rallying now, you know, he's getting better now. And, you know, with thing with terminal lucidity, and it's not always the case.
And that, I think, can be heartbreaking because there's a guilt and a grief of, well, did I do something wrong, or did the doctors do something wrong?
Yeah, and what I always tell people is that, you know, when people experience this, this is a sign often of imminent death, and this is a good time to share your last memories and your thoughts, to finish any business. You know, I started sharing with my father some of my most meaningful moments with him, and he got a little bit emotional, and he said, you know, I felt bad I never took you to a ball game, because, you know, he was in the height of his career in those days. And I said, Dad, I hated to go to ball games. That's one of the positive things I'm going to say at your eulogy. You never made me go to a ball game. And he started laughing, and he enjoyed that comment. And then I told him a truth that I had been once talked in by friends to going to a baseball game one night. You know, I'm pretty sure they said to me, come on, 9 innings, couple of hours. Anyway, it turned out that it was a twilight doubleheader, which I immediately would welch.
Yeah.
And it became the books, because after that, they changed the rules. The first game was 10 innings, and the second was 26.
Oh, Brutal.
And I shared that story, and, you know, and I said, believe me, I had enough bowl games to last my entire life. So, you know, it was a good moment between us, and a moment I still smile at.
The book is When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End. My guest is Dr. Kenneth Doka. You also include the paranormal experience with mediums, and some wonderful children's experiences, like the little kid who said, I'm going to Jupiter. We're going to come back in just a few. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Wendy's Coffee House.
And as I said, it can involve any of the senses. You know, you can hear your name being called, or all of a sudden seem to see the person.
The book is When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End. Ken Doka is my guest, and this covers the gamut. When people check out, nobody does it just like everyone else. Each person has their own unique way of transitioning. And some of that we have failed to become, I think, more enlightened about in our society, Western society, that it's okay to have these paranormal experiences, that there may be something involving things you don't understand, like knocks on the door or scents or a hug, those kind of things. And I love the fact you include all of this in your book. So was there a favorite part when you were researching this?
I guess my favorite part, well, I you know, it's like asking you who your favorite child is. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Throw one out.
I only have one, so that's easy for me to talk about. I think each chapter had its own pleasure and its own piece, but probably the one that resonated most with me was the chapter on extraordinary experiences, or what I like to call post-bereavement experiences. Yeah. And these are the experiences that people have after a death. And they could be a variety of different things. It could be many of the things that you talked about, you know, that you you have a sense experience of the other person, you're in bed one night and all of a sudden you feel that somebody's hugging you, you know, or you smell a smell associated with that person. It can be just it could be dreams, probably the most common, where you dream of the person. And those dreams can take a variety of different forms. We can talk about those later if you'd like. And then there are, you know, symbolic things where maybe you see something, you know, maybe somebody said to you before they die, you know, I'm like a butterfly, you know, and this is when you, and right now I'm in a cocoon, and one day I'll emerge from that, and you're at the graveside, and all of a sudden a butterfly flutters up. Or they can be experiences where somebody else says something that really seems like a message of the deceased, and then there can be a sense of presence. And I think why that really resonates with me is that was one of the experiences that I had and I talked about in the book, a very personal experience. A number of years ago, a good friend of mine was dying of cancer, and he was dying, he was very young, and he was dying right around the time that his son was turning four, actually died the day before his son turned four. And I was his son's godfather. And when I came over to see him one day, he really stressed to me, I need you to watch out over my son. I need you, you know, you're his godfather. I need you to be his godfather. I need you to, you know, the old responsibility of when, you know, if a parent dies, you step in. And that was a role I took very, very seriously. And, you know, and we really were very good with Keith as family. And we took Keith on family vacations, and he adored my son, who was, you know, 13 years older, but still looked at him like a big brother and a good friend. And one time we were in the Bahamas, we took Keith with us, and I just decided to take a walk on the beach that night. And the only way I could describe this feeling, this was about 5 years after maybe he had died, the only way I could describe this feeling is I felt that every cell in my body was being individually hugged.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I felt that was his dad's kind of saying thank you. But there was also a sadness to it, because I had felt his presence lightly before then at different times. But I felt he was also saying goodbye. You know, he was saying, you've kept your promise, and I know you're going to keep your promise, and I need to go on. You know, and so it was an incredible experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's almost more real than real.
Yeah. It certainly was real to me. And I think the key in these things is, as I said in the book, they don't fit easily into my theology. I like to consider myself, a social scientist. They don't always fit easy into that. But certainly these kinds of things happen and experienced by lots of people lots of times.
Okay. Lutheran minister?
Yeah.
Okay. And so with your, to reconcile that, because some of this had to be a little bit more illuminating as you came across these experiences. How did that feel as you're learning and reading and realizing these things happen?
Yeah, I don't think it was that difficult because I think, when I was in seminary, I took the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphase Personality Test.
Yeah.
And one of the things I came out on is a non-judging type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are the dimensions? So, I can hold contradictory ideas and say, yeah, I believe this, but, I don't know how this fits in, but certainly had that experience.
Part of it, I think, with the paranormal things, going back to some of the experiences, there was a person, a woman, I think she, her husband, oh, no, maybe it's a guy. His wife always brought chocolate back to him. And she went shopping early or jogging or something in the morning. And then, so what his experience is that in the morning he has this taste, nobody else is around, but the chocolate taste that she brought. And he feels that presence is still there. So, these things are, as you say, extraordinary.
Yeah. And as I said, it can involve any of the senses. You can hear your name being called or all of a sudden seem to see the person or, my first encounter actually with this was when I was counseling a woman whose daughter died at three. And I talk about that story in the book, whose daughter died at three from sudden infant death syndrome, which is, late for that to happen, but still can happen. And it was a first child and her only child. She was a young woman and she was coming to me for counseling. And the big question was, should I have other children? And, I can never go through this again. Nobody can promise that it won't happen again, but at the same point, I never perceived myself and I never perceived my husband and I as being childless. So she's really struggling with this conflict. Do I dare do this again with no guarantees that the next child will survive? Mm-hmm. And one day she came into my office and she was aglow. And she said, I don't know if I ever told you this. But she said, when my daughter was younger, when my daughter was alive, she used to love it when I put perfume, when I was going out for dinner or going out for some occasion, I would use this perfume, some expensive perfume. And she said, my daughter would always make me put a dab of it by her ears. And then she'd go out to the room and make sure everyone smelled her and see how she smelled nice, just like mommy,
Mm-hmm.
It was a great mother-daughter moment.
Yes.
And the last thing she did before they closed the casket is she anointed her with this perfume and then put the bottle in the casket and then switched to another brand because that perfume was so associated with her daughter she couldn't use it anymore. And she said, I went to my daughter's room. And all of a sudden, the smell of that perfume was pervasive. She said, I even called my husband in without telling him and said, what do you smell, dear? And he said, I thought you switched brands. I thought you changed perfumes. And she said, I did. And she showed him the perfume that, she was using, which had a, very different, smell.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked. I was maybe 27 years old. I was a young counselor. This is the first time I'd experienced anything like this. I didn't know if she was hallucinating, I didn't know what was going on. And I remember I probably said the right thing. I said, what did that experience mean to you? And she said, it was my daughter telling me she was okay. And then soon after that, she decided that she would risk another pregnancy or risk another child. And ultimately, she had three children. I'd always get sort of these transitional notes every once in a while, when one of them graduated from high school or reached some significant event.
Mm-hmm.
It was, incredible experience for her and for me to hear it. But as I said, I didn't know how to take it. There was nothing written on that at that point in time.
Well, there are a lot of those stories in here. So we're going to take a quick break and find out more. The third-party experiences are kind of interesting as well. My guest, Ken Doka, and the book is a compilation of all types of things that you might experience when someone is transitioning. And it's fascinating, and you don't rule anything out. I like that. When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End.
The website, drkendoka.com.
Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. I know that when my own grandmother passed, I had no idea what to expect. I was grieving a tremendous loss. And then I got some information from her that she wanted a certain song played at her funeral, I Only Want to Dance with You by George Strait. Finding out later that she was a huge George Strait fan and I had moved away from home, my aunt took her to see George Strait perform, and that was one of the highlights of her life in terms of worshiping a singer. And the other thing was that I was in grief and I felt this wonderful energy maybe 2 or 3 days after she died. And all of a sudden, it took my grief away. And I knew that my grandmother had checked in to say, it's okay, I'm fine. And so these kinds of experiences, I knew that that was happening with my grandmother. But I know other people have those kinds of experiences we don't always share because we don't know how to talk about it. And that's what I think you help in the book by bringing this wide, wide variety of experiences that people have had and sharing your own to give people permission to talk about what happens when we
die. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, and I think that's true. I'll tell you a story. I went to a conference. I'm a member of an association of people who study grief and loss and death and dying called the Association for Death Education and Counseling. And a number of years ago, many years ago, and I think I talk about that in the introduction, there was a presentation of these kinds of experiences, these after-death kinds of experiences by a woman by the name of Bonnie Lindstrom. And a bunch of us went to hear it. And then, you know, we, as goes in conferences, we all recessed to the bar to have a drink. And we all started sharing. We were all counselors and researchers and writers, and we all shared our own experiences with clients, you know, like the experience that I shared about the woman with perfume. And then we started laughing. We said, you know, here we are, like to think of ourselves as very innovative and very competitive, you know, people, academics. And we've all experienced this, but none of us ever wrote about it. You know, none of us ever further explored it. And, you know, we all realized as much as we had these experiences, we didn't want to be the first one to, you know, to first write about this because we thought somebody would say, yeah, Doka used to do some good work years ago. And then he got into this really goofy stuff, you know? And so I think we were all surprised how common these experiences were. And Bonnie's research said about 60% of people had these experiences after a significant loss, but nobody talks about them, you know, because they're almost afraid that, you know, that somebody with a net's going to come around in a straitjacket.
Well, one I remember hearing about probably, you know, 20 or 30 years ago when I worked in retail, they talked about going to the hospital and I think it was a grandparent that had died and watching a ball of light emerge from the body, go on the floor and zoom out the door. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that was really like a lightning ball. You know, they call them those.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was just like, okay, see you gone. And that was I thought that was one of the first most unconventional types of departures that I heard about. And I thought, wow, how is that possible? And what does that mean? And having my own experience, you know, the light, that's part of who we are. And to experience that would be extraordinary and give you a change of, I think, you know, beliefs of reference of what we think of when we die. A positive, I think, in my opinion, a positive experience.
Yeah, I think most people who have these kinds of experiences, one of the things we've seen, for example, about near-death experiences where, you know, where people have, you know, have had some kind of experience, for most of them, it's very positive. And for most of them, one of the implications of it is they find out their anxiety about death has significantly decreased.
I remember when Eben Alexander came out with his book. Before then, near-death experiences like, oh, you can't prove it, it doesn't happen. He was hooked up to every possible tube you could think of to actually document the fact that he did not have anything registering in terms of brain activity at the time he had this extraordinary experience and coming back and being able to talk about it and share what he knew with the documentation of all of those tubes and little gadgets mm-hmm. that he was hooked up to. It changed people's minds. In a big way.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I think you know, we can clearly say these experiences have been shared by a lot of people throughout history, across cultures. You know, you can determine what they mean, whether they're simply hallucinations or lack of oxygen or what have you, but you can't deny that they exist.
There's one in the book you talk about, and I think this is the child who wanted to be a doctor, and his dad was a doctor. And so the father died, and he had to go take a test, and he was grieving, and he was just really nervous and thinking, I can't do this without dad, basically, I think. You remember the story?
This should be more one of those presence ones. He felt strongly his father's presence with him that day. And the answers came quickly, as I recall.
Yes. Yeah. And he aced the test. And he's like, he knew dad helped him with that.
And, you know, even more remarkable, or equally remarkable, I think, are where those experiences where a third person says something to you that really kind of seems like it's a message or something. You know, and I share in there a story about my son. My son was very close to his grandmother, my mother, and my mother was getting elderly, and one night she ended up getting, she took a hot shower right before she went to bed, and the steam must have swelled the door. She couldn't get out of the door, so she ended up sleeping in the bathroom that night until she could finally wedge the door open. You know, nothing you want to see your 88-year-old mother dealing with. So we tried to hire people to be night sitters, so to speak. And of course, as soon as we hired them, she fired them, you know, and said, you know, my kids are overprotective. I don't need it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so my son was looking, was in between, you know, his lease was coming to an end. He was going into a marriage. And we said, look, you're looking for some place to stay for the next 6 months. He was living in the city. I said, why don't you stay with grandma? Everybody would love that. And grandma won't fire you. You know, we'll have a presence in the house.
Hopefully.
Yeah, and so he did, and it really worked out well. She really renewed her vigor, so to speak, you know, and actually thoroughly enjoyed having him. And you could see she had much more pep, you know, and she was making dinner for him and liked the idea. She was making dinner and having healthier meals because she had to feed her grandson, you know, rather than just opening a tuna can, you know. And all that was wonderful. And what ended up happening is that one day she called him at work, and she had a journal that my father had written. And she loved to read it every day because they had a 75-year marriage virtually, not quite, but pretty close, maybe 70 years or 65, somewhere in the 60s. And the journal was just a testimony to his love for her. And so she enjoyed reading it in the absence. And one day she called him, said, Michael, I can't find the journal. And he said, don't worry, Grandma. He said, we haven't thrown out the garbage, so there's no way. It's got to be in the house. Nothing has left the house, you know, since yesterday. It probably fell into the chair. You know, she had this big chair. And he said, I'll find it. And she was fine with that because my sister called later that day and she said, oh, I misplaced Dad's journal, but Mike's going to find it. Anyway, later that day, she took a bad fall and she never recovered from that. She essentially died in the hospital a few days later. And Michael took comfort from the fact that he said, well, maybe she, you know, maybe the journal was a sign that she didn't need the journal anymore because she was going to be with Grandpa. And that gave him some comfort. And one day he's walking up the street and this old neighbor of ours, we lived in that house for a long time, came out and said, Michael, he said, I want to share with you. He said, my wife had a wonderful dream. She saw your mother and father walking up and down the street hand in hand, as they often did. And to him, that was a validation of his thought.
This is the one about the child who is a premonition. And the little boy says, I'm going to Jupiter. And okay, fine. Yeah, he's going to go. That's where he lived before. That's the family he had on Jupiter. And do you remember that one?
I remember that he would say this ever since he was a little child.
Yeah.
That he would tell him he was from Jupiter, and they laughed. And then, but he kept saying, "I've come back before, you know, before a certain year, when he was 7 or 8, I forget the exact year." And sure enough, he developed an illness, and he said, "I'm going to Jupiter. It's time." But you know, but the notion was that ever since he was a little boy, he seemed to know that he wasn't going to live past a certain year.
And that one was fascinating, just because he had a preset date, and not that it was, you know, on the calendar, but he knew his time was going to be a short duration.
Very short. Yeah.
We're going to come back in just a minute. There's so much going on with COVID right now. People are losing loved ones. And
of course,
there's a lot of grief. And this is overwhelming in so many ways. So your book, I think, is going to be really helpful. When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End.
Website for Dr. Doka is drkandoka.com.
Back in a few. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Mediums can be very helpful, in my experience.
When she said that, it really just, I said, I can remember that all immediately. She even said the road had a seven in it.
Wendy's Coffee House, Ken Doka is my guest.
When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End.
This is all about death. In so many different ways, we deal with grief and we deal with letting go. It isn't always on our time frame. This is a 9/11 story.
Yeah, and that was the story, I think, of this woman who shared with me that right before they went to work, her husband went to work in the towers, they'd had an argument, you know, which happens between couples, of course. And then normally when they would come back, they would make up and everything would be fine, or they'd get a call later in the day and they'd deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, of course, he died pretty much after he got seen into the office. And I think the nice thing here about it is that there was nothing extraordinary about this. And one of the points I'm trying to make at this point in time is so many times we long for these experiences, but yet there are things we can do in the absence of these experiences that could help us in the same way. She would have loved a visit or hearing her husband's voice or something that conveyed forgiveness. But what she did at the funeral, at the graveside, was put a bouquet of forget-me-nots there and then write a letter of apology. And that was that they had that stupid fight. And that was enough for her. So I think one of the messages we want to give today is that, you know, as I said, about 60% of people have these experiences, but a significant number of people don't have them. And when they hear about them, say, you know, I wish I could do something. And I think the important point we want to make, and I make in a concluding chapter, is that we never lose the bond with the person. One of the ways our theories of grief have changed is that we no longer look at grief as detaching from the person, investing energy in new people and moving on. You know, I always tell my students to bring closure to the word closure. We always retain a connection with the people we love, and that can be a source of comfort in the memories, in the experiences, in the legacies that they've given us. You know, we don't always need the extraordinary. The ordinary sometimes works well, too.
There are some times, though, when a medium can help fill in the blanks. And, of course, you need to be cautious. That's a whole nother ball of wax. But mediums can be very helpful, in my experience, because sometimes it's that last-minute bit of closure that you get in an extraordinary and unconventional way when they have just the right words at just the right time. You had experience with a medium that kind of surprised you, too.
Yeah, in the book, I have a chapter on mediums and the like. And again, you know, I've been to a number of mediums. Some of them you feel they're kind of searching, and others just seem to hit right on things right away. And again, probably some of my extraordinary experiences are involved with my godson's father. And one of my most remarkable experiences, and I have to tell you something about him. I had met him, he's 10 years younger than me, he was 10 years younger than me, and I met him in a delinquency prevention program. So what the goal was we were supposed to, they wanted college-bound kids from our neighborhood to mentor kids at quote-unquote risk for delinquency. And as soon as I met this 10-year-old, I realized he wasn't at risk for delinquency. He was quite delinquent. But we developed a great relationship over the time. And he was a lot of fun. He was perky and he was funny and, you know, and all those kinds of good things.
I remember the one about the fishing lures. when y'all went fishing.
Oh yeah, oh, it was all right. That was when I was just telling that story about him. That was an extraordinary. But what happened with the fishing lures is that one time we were out, and we had a rule about being honest with each other. That was like one of our understandings. And he lost a lot of fishing lures on me because we were encouraged to take them on activities with us, and I liked to fish in those days. So we'd go fishing at this nice quiet lake, and he loved it because it got him out of the city. But he wasn't very patient as a fisherman, and he would just pull a lure until it broke. And he lost a lot of lures on me. And one day when I opened my tackle box, he put a dozen new lures into my tackle box, or half a dozen new lures into my tackle box. And I looked at him and I said, "Michael, are these hot?" And he looked at me like very disappointed that I would ask that question. And he said, "I would tell you if they were hot." And I actually felt really bad. And I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry." And about 5 years later, we're together and we're fishing, and he opens up the tackle box and he says, "You still got the hot lures?" And I said, "Wait a minute, you swore to me they weren't hot." He said, "No." He said, "I remember exactly what I told you."
Yeah.
He said, "I would tell you if they were hot." And then he smiled, he had a great smile. He said, "I never said when I tell you." And I told that story at his funeral because that was a signature story. That was a story anybody who knew him could relate to that. He never really lied to you, but you really had to make sure you asked the right questions.
Well, what I think about the interesting thing here with the mediums is that they keep picking up on him, that he's still in part of you or involved or aware, you know, in some way, shape or form, because they keep getting hits on him.
Yeah, and the one story that was really remarkable, which really put chills to me at the time, is I was with this medium, and as we were talking, she said, "You feel very guilty about someone." And she said, it starts with an M, you know, and then she said, "Mark, Michael," and I said, "Yeah, there's this person, Michael." She says, he said she shouldn't feel guilty, because I always felt like maybe... you know, the drug abuse, he was clean at the time he died. But before then he had struggled with drug abuse, and that certainly had deteriorated his health and certainly was an issue in his death. And so she said, "He wants you to know you shouldn't feel guilty, that, you know, that he always felt you did your best and you were very good, and that's why he wanted you." And she even said, "That's why he wanted you." And I never even talked about this, a role in his child's life. Which, you know, kind of was, wow, how did you know all that, you know?
Right.
Then she said something that was really interesting. She said, "One time he saved your life." And I'm trying to think of, I don't remember this little kid saving my life, or it wasn't a little kid by the time he died. And she said, "No, this was after he died." She said, "You were on a trail. You were on a road. It was very late. It was unexpectedly late." And she said, you started to fall asleep at the wheel. And he woke you. And if he hadn't woken you, you would have hit a truck." And all of a sudden, it came back to me that one night I was going. It was funny because I was going on Route 17. My plane got late into the airport. It was like a 2-hour delay, and I was coming into LaGuardia, and I had to go to Syracuse, which was about a 3-hour ride. And all of a sudden, so instead of going at like 7 o'clock, it was now past 10. You know, by the time I got my suitcase and stuff, it was almost 11. So I even thought about calling his wife, because they sort of lived in Warwick, New York, which was on the way, and saying, "Maybe I'll just go up to, you know, to my godson's house and sleep there for the night and then leave early in the morning." And then I thought, no, I don't want to wake them up at night and wake them up in the morning. It's really not worth it. But I don't remember falling asleep, but I remember being jarred awake and seeing this truck that I was, you know, I felt was getting too close to me. So I stopped in a diner and, you know, got iced tea and stuff. And when she said that, it really just, I said, I can remember that all immediately. Yeah. She even said the road had a 7 in it.
I love that. That's an example of how they're still checking in on us, whether we know it or not.
Yeah.
The book is called When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End. Okay, we didn't get to the dream part because you, who are listening, will have to do your homework and read the book. Okay, so there you go. That's a tease. And the website, this is also available on Amazon. You can check it out there. But your website is drkendoka.com.
That's correct.
Anything else you want to add?
That's about it. Thank you very much.
Again, the book, When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End. You'll find some links in the description for this show. And you can check my blogs, Wendy's Coffee House and Talking to Nightlights. Thanks for listening.